I don't know, man. Like, Vettel in his final days at Aston Martin, he wasn't quick. Like, he wasn't, like, really, really quick. Like, he's there and, like, you know, for the vibes.
The Mercedes car isn't that quick either.
That's true as well. Yeah, but I mean, he was there for the vibes. He was there for the vibes and feel. So, just like, but there's...
That's kind of the case in Mercedes now as well. Just kind of there for the vibes.
Welcome to Race Pod.
Welcome back to Race Pod. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Jonathan.
Together, we are co-hosts of Race Pod, where we talk about all things Formula One.
RacePod is the extension of Race Recap, a LinkedIn newsletter created by two F1 fans where we discuss the world of Formula One and wider motorsports. RacePod serves as an extension to that content pillar where we will speak about various off-track events from the world of from Formula One, as well as looking at other motorsports around the whole community of motorsports in the general world.
All right, we're back with another episode. So in the previous episode, we covered quite a few things, actually, you know, from, you know, the Alpine meltdown to the potential trouble at Red Bull Brewing with a lot of the off-track drama that was happening. Yeah, and then right after that, we got an exciting race right before this race weekend at the time of recording, which is China. Last time out in Australia, it was crazy, right? You know, Carlos Sainz won the race, which is just insane considering he's, like, jobless for next season. Yeah, but I mean, what are your thoughts about the first three races so far, John?
I mean, it's now the first four races, I think, like, considering at the time of recording, where it was Bahrain, Saudi, Australia, and now Japan, which we are currently awaiting for the Chinese Grand Prix in this coming weekend. So I think to no one's surprise that Max won 3 out of 4. It could have been 4 out of 4, but then there were some Red Bull gremlins and reliability there, which gave emotional Ferrari fans a good one too. Carlos Sainz showed that sometimes saving wind just means removing an appendix. Who knew, right? So that was interesting. The Japanese Grand Prix, Japan's always been an interesting track, which the biggest shock to me was that Ferrari gave a good strategy. I didn't expect
that.
Who knew? So, yeah, and I think it was another case of Hamilton and Mercedes struggling with their performance and tires, and you just get the feeling that Hamilton's just kind of done with the silver arrows and just kind of wait for 2025.
Yeah, he's kind of like just cruising through. I mean, it's a real pity, right? Because in Australia, I think none of them Hamilton retired, George crashed out on the last lap, and then you go to Japan, which is like, even though they had glimpses of speed during free practice and in the race, it was just, it's just Mercedes. So on to, you know, passing through the motion and looking forward to 2025. I think there's one driver who is really, really excited about his 2025 prospect and even 2026. So obviously we have to get to the big news that Alonso has finally made one of the biggest signing of his career, possibly the longest contract he's ever signed with Aston Martin on a new multi-year deal that will extend his racing career all the way to 2025 and even into 2026 with the new regulations. And it's also kind of interesting because he's finally reuniting with Honda again, and we all know how that turned out with the McLaren-Honda partnership. So yeah, I mean, really, really interesting news. So obviously this is the big update that we got, and with this, it kind of like answers a few questions with the driver market, right? So the next question is like, so where is Sainz going to go? And then after that, will he hold on to that second Red Bull seat, which, you know, is currently held by Perez? Will he replace Max Verstappen? Or if Red Bull isn't really an option, will he go to Mercedes? Or will he even go to Sauber, which is all the way in the back of the grid at the moment, but they're going to become Audi in 2026? So yeah, I mean, before I go on, like, what are your thoughts, John, you know, Alonso to Aston Martin? You know, is it one of the best moves he could make? Are you surprised by it? Yeah.
I mean, I always felt that Alonso probably still wants to try for the Triple Crown. So I was a bit disappointed that he didn't try like a full-time one in Indy, or maybe just going for the Dakar again with Toyota or something like that. Because besides Aston Martin's Formula One efforts, it's like a point that you'll come to later, is that the Aston Martin team will be entering the World Endurance Championship in 2026. So that's something that it could be interesting that they would tap into Alonso already, as because he is an endurance champion. He has won Le Mans. So that could be a pet benefit to them. But for Alonso, that's already something that he's already conquered. He's the first driver to be inducted into the FIA Hall of Fame in two sports. So I'm guessing he's comfortable there. Like, the team seems to value him. There's no GP2 or GP3 engine.
Yeah.
For now, we'll never know when Honda comes back and then it turns out to be a go-kart engine. But yeah, I guess it's a surprise, and credit is due, Aston Martin is a lot more stable than Alpine, isn't it?
Yeah. Good point you made over there about the whole Alpine reference. Yeah, I think in terms of, like, it's a win-win for both Aston and Alonso, right? Like, Aston needs a very strong, experienced driver to obviously carry them forward into the new regulations with the success they have had in 2023, and also given the fact that Honda was the one that powered Max Verstappen to his first world championship, and the fact that Aston got them together to become, I think, like a works team, it's amazing. And I think I've read reports that they actually asked, you know, Alonso, so what do you think about, like, the last time you and Honda met, it really didn't end up well, right? So what's it like going into this second round of going again with Honda? And he actually responded, I think the Honda representatives actually responded that they're okay, like, they know what happened during the McLaren Honda years, and they're ready to put that behind them, and they are ready to, you know, work with Alonso again into this new chapter. And I think in terms of the details of his contract as well, he didn't specify the length, but apparently at any point in time, if he feels like he's done with racing, there's still the ambassadorial value with Aston Martin as well, which obviously adds to his career. But yeah, I mean, if there was rumors that he was going to go to Mercedes, right? He's not going to be the number one driver. And we know Alonso, like, he's not going to go anywhere that doesn't put him as the number one driver. So I think it's a very stable move for him. You know, just, you know, right, I have a few more years of racing in my career, so why not just stay with a team that clearly values me rather than, you know, making the switch? But yeah, in terms of Mercedes or even Red Bull, I mean, obviously there were the what ifs, right? You know, what if Alonso went to Mercedes, and what if Alonso went to Red Bull? That's a story that we'll never really know. But I'd like to hear your thoughts about, like, in terms of Mercedes now, they've lost out on one big potential signing, and I'm not really sure whether Sainz will go to Mercedes. And it seems that they are putting a lot of their eggs in junior Kimi Antonelli, who is preparing for his F1 campaign. He's currently in F2. But yeah, I just want to hear your thoughts on, you know, rather than losing out on a chance to sign a big driver like Alonso and going all in on a rookie who you're not entirely sure is able to perform. Like, you're not sure whether he's going to be a Max Verstappen, right? So yeah, I want to hear your thoughts about Kimi Antonelli and Mercedes losing out on Alonso.
I think the rumors in going around the paddock was that Alonso always seemed to be Mercedes plan B. Like, I think that Toto always holds Kimi Antonelli as their plan A. I'm not sure how wise that is, but apparently he's that highly rated. And I mean, there have also always been rumors that with the chaos erupting around Red Bull, there have always been rumors that they're trying to tempt Max to come over. Not sure how realistic that would be. That would be a blockbuster if that was the case. Sainz, to me, I would think Sainz honestly would suit Audi more. I think, like, he could be the team leader there. Andrea Seidel's there. They're looking for a strong established driver to lead Audi into the new rules era. Carlos Sainz Sr. has driven for Audi in the Rally Championship. Who knows? It sounds like it could be a good fit. So I don't think Sainz was that realistic, right, for a Mercedes target. He seems more like an Audi target. And I mean, just for jokes at this point, like, why not Mikko Hülkenberg, I guess, because, like, why not? He's not really doing anything in Haas now, is he?
I think he's linked to the Audi seat as well. And I think in terms of, like, stability,
yeah,
and
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a Bottas going to Alfa Romeo. Wait, Bottas went to Alfa Romeo, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Before they became the
Sauber
state. thing.
Yeah. So it's kind of like that. Like, you know, Sainz going to Sauber, even though it's like a downgrade, like, you know, he's going to be there for a few more years. But yeah, I mean, it's like a 50-50 kind of thing where it's either Audi hits the mark with the 2026 car or they completely miss the mark. And I think there were reports to suggest that Audi and their projections with the 2026 car weren't looking that happy. So yeah.
I mean, I'll throw my hat with one exciting one, but personally, I half want this to happen and half don't want it to happen. Why not ask Sebastian Vettel to come back?
Oh, to where? Mercedes?
To Mercedes. But if he joins up with Porsche for the World Endurance Championship, which I would prefer, I doubt that the German brands would want him to represent Porsche and then Mercedes as well. I think there's a conflict there. So I don't think that will happen, but that would be a story, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like Michael Schumacher back to Mercedes kind of thing. But
exactly.
I don't know, man. Like, Vettel in his final days at Aston Martin, I mean he wasn't quick. Like, he wasn't, like, really, really quick. Like, he's there and, like, you know, for the vibes.
The Mercedes car isn't that quick either.
That's true as well. Yeah, but I mean, he was there for the vibes. He was there for the vibes and feel. So, just like, but there's...
That's kind of the case in Mercedes now as well. Just kind of there for the vibes.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking about vibes and feel, I wonder how, like, Daniel Ricciardo is feeling right now. Right? I mean, considering his performance in the first three races. So, you know, why not just walk us through what the Honey Badger is feeling right now at the moment? I'm sure it's not that great. So, yeah.
So, okay. So, just a short moment back to the past. This weekend will be the first time that F1 has come back to the Chinese Grand Prix since 2019. A lot has changed in that 5 years. Vettel was still highly valued at Ferrari. Lando Norris was still in debut season. Back then, Ricciardo was still a very highly valued prospect. He was paying big bucks to move from Red Bull to Renault. He seemed excited about the possibility. Usually in hindsight, wasn't that great a possibility. And there was quite some value in that because Ricciardo was a multiple race winner. He matched up well with Max Verstappen, and now he's going to a factory team with Renault before the chaos.
Yeah,
somewhat. So, and that was in 2019. Now, all the way in 2024, Ricciardo's 2024 season has not been great. So far in the races, he's been quite comprehensively outperformed by Yuki Tsunoda, which, in the Red Bull teams, I think has actually been quite underrated, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I mean, Yuki finally scored points in his home race. I think he got, a P7 in Australia?
Yeah, something like that. I think, like, he got some decent points.
Yeah, decent points. So, yeah, I think Yuki, we all thought that, you know, Daniel Ricciardo, an eight-time race winner, you know, would be able to beat Yuki, right? And Yuki has been in recarb/AlphaTauri for about, like, four seasons now. So it's really interesting to see the differential in terms of, like, the performance. And then the funny thing about China, right? I think China was also the track that Daniel Ricciardo was very, very famous for late braking, right? During his Red Bull days. I remember seeing a lot of clips of it.
Yeah, that was one of his last wins, I think. That was in 2018. He had like a late breaking masterclass. He stormed through, overtook Vettel and Bottas, and then like that was one of his last few wins. Pretty impressive race, which I remembered. But I think like that season after that, like just reliability failed him, and then a year later he was with Team Enstone, which doesn't look that great in hindsight. But back to Ricciardo at VCAR, there've already been rumors in the paddock that Helmut Marko may want to replace Daniel Ricciardo with Liam Lawson, which, if our viewers remember, did pretty decently and scored some points when he was replacing Ricciardo last year as Ricciardo injured his hand at the Dutch Grand Prix. So there have been rumors on that, and personally, I think it might be possible, especially I think he was given the deadline by the Miami Grand Prix. If he doesn't improve, that he might be replaced by Liam Lawson. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we all seen how ruthless Red Bull is with their driver's program, right? Nick De Vries was booted, I think, about, 10 races in. Wasn't given a lot of time as well. So, time is definitely ticking for Honey Badger. I mean, I don't know whether they'll swap him for mid-season, but it doesn't really look good for Daniel in terms of, like, getting a contract renewal for 2025 or even staying for 2026. So, definitely he's feeling the pressure as well. And speaking about change, there's actually been like a big change at McLaren. So I'm not sure if our listeners remember, about last year, they made this huge technical shakeup, and they brought people from Red Bull, they brought people from Ferrari. The Ferrari hire was David Sanchez. And then after that, just 3 months into his new role at McLaren, he's already left. Yeah, so basically he left. And then after that, there was another new technical shakeup at McLaren again. So the new structure would be Rob Marshall will assume the role of chief designer. Neil Hardy will move on to become technical director of engineering. And Peter Prodromov will continue his role as technical director of aerodynamics. So, I mean, the very short summary of the whole why it happened, why did he leave after 3 months is that the expectation of his role coming in and what he actually did was just really, really different, right? There were reports to suggest that he was a very senior role in Ferrari, right? So when he came to McLaren, there was the expectations that he will be leading the charge in terms of like the design of the car. But obviously that wasn't really the case because it's a 3-man technical team being overseen by Andrea Stella. So yeah, that's pretty much what happened. But I think, yeah, what are your thoughts, John? Especially, you know, as we discussed in like just one or two episodes ago, we've seen what these kind of technical shakeups can happen, and spoiler alert, doesn't really look really, really good. So yeah, I mean, over to you, John.
I mean, I would like to remind our listeners that one of my preseason predictions was there was going to be one big technical shakeup. So far, there've been two. So I'm pretty confident about that prediction. It's like that's already been fulfilled. But I've been reading Adrian Newey's book. Like I read it quite a few months ago, and this reminds me of like a matrix structure, right? Because McLaren back in those days in the early 2000s, they split the role of the technical director into multiple departments, yeah. Specifically like technical director of aerodynamics and then like car concept and things like that. So seems like Andrea Stella has done something similar here. So they've reduced like the dependency on one, but they've created like a more flatter structure. So I guess it seems like there's like a organizational reshuffle and everything before David Sanchez came in, which I guess part of it is unfair, but part of it is like it's a bit hard to blame McLaren as well, because they had to wait for about close to 6 to 9 months as David Sanchez had to resign and leave Ferrari, and then like he had to serve out his notice, and then there's like gardening leave and things like that. So it's a bit unfair, but it's also not to say unexpected. But then again, it's kind of like the thing that is good that it's solved quickly before things happen. But yeah, what do you think about it, Nathan?
Yeah, I actually got a question. Like, what's the difference with like the various technical structures in different teams, right? Some teams have just one chief engineer designing the car, and you have teams like Alpine and McLaren where they have like a team of senior technical leaders overseeing the development of the car. So obviously, I think in terms of like the logic would say like, you know, if you're only reporting to one person, technically it should be a lot, you know, streamlined, a lot faster. But obviously, if you have more than one person overseeing the development of the car, you get different opinions on how the car should be designed, whether it's the aerodynamic philosophy or just, you know, any other gaps in the engineering knowledge that the other person can fill. So yeah, I'm just curious on your thoughts, like what's the difference between both structures and what are like the benefits and drawbacks?
I mean, I guess the differences is down to how the team envisions or what's their philosophy on it. Like the simplest example I would think would be look at how Red Bull and the importance that Adrian Newey has in that organization. He's basically the guy for all things related to the car. Mercedes had something similar with James Allison, because with James Allison, it was a while back that he was upgraded to his role as CTO of Mercedes, and then Mike Allian took his place as technical director. But then Mercedes again had to reshuffle and then put James Allison back, and Mike Allian took the CTO role before he left a bit later. So
right,
there's always like one main guy for the car. So The difference would be the benefits is that if that guy is really capable, he's able to like just oversee everything and then delegate individual department heads or like head of aerodynamics and head of chassis and like things like that. The downside is it requires one guy to be like at least decent enough to see the whole picture.
Yeah.
Rather than having like very special knowledge on just like that aspect, which I guess is kind of what McLaren is doing. For Alpine, I never understand what they're doing anyway. It's insane.
I feel like every episode we're going to attack Alpine non-stop, but okay, but we'll try not to. But I mean,
for any of our friends that we have in Alpine, I'm sorry. It's like Nathan has a close contact with Alpine, at least like somebody in the Alpine team. I'm sorry if you're listening to this, but like some of the decisions we don't understand.
I totally agree with you. Like changing the team this early into the season is just a bit odd. But yeah, speaking about teams and knowing changes and, you know, hires and stuff like that, apparently there's some news that Andretti is opening up. They already opened up a new facility in Silverstone. And walk us through it, John, because I remember you actually wrote an article when Andretti did their Formula One bid, and also we did talk about it in terms of like when Formula One rejected Andretti's bid into the sport. So yeah, just walk us through it.
Having followers of race recap and everything, we realized that I think like we came out with an article pretty quickly based on like the what are the legal implications if Andretti is not admitted into Formula One, which they aren't. So kudos for predictions there. So what they're doing right now is like they seem to be firming up and like they are increasing their capacity even though they haven't been admitted yet, especially with the recent Formula One management rejection a couple of months back. What they've done recently is they've opened a new facility in Silverstone, which besides being home to the British Grand Prix, there are quite a number of teams based in nearby locations. As it is, Aston Martin is just based down the road from Silverstone, so good enough. One of the big reasons that they have this is Andretti is not being a US-based team. Their main base of operations is Indianapolis, in the US. So maybe the US-based races, maybe they can Canada, Mexico, Brazil, it's convenient enough for them, but it's hard for them to operate for the European and Asian races. They open this and they're like easy to attract staff as well, which Andretti has done more of the same. Like they've recruited ex-Lotus Nick Chester, as well as Graham Loudon, which was the Manor team boss from a couple of years ago. They've made credible Formula One additions. We've also heard stories that they're planning to enter for F2 and F3 to support the FIA ladder. So Andretti is putting his money where his mouth is. He's putting in effort. He's putting in resources. And we are still hearing that they're preparing their car. So FIM is being pressured basically to let them in, especially if Andretti decides to pursue this in court, which there could be a possibility of anti-competition implications right there, especially if they are prevented. There have been rumors of a new Concorde agreement limiting it to 10 teams, which would be very anti-competitive. And it could go the same way as how the Super League is in football and they get struck down by the European courts. But yeah, any thoughts on that, Nathan?
Say what you want about Andretti, but yeah, I mean, unlike another American outfit, quote-unquote Gene Haas, he's really putting where his money is worth. I mean, you have one US team owner who basically refused to further invest in his team and expects result. And you have another iconic American team owner who wants to get into sport, who's actually heavily investing to continue his F1 challenge, even though like he's not really getting the necessary approval from the FOM. So yeah, I mean, his money is where it's worth, man. So yeah, kudos to him. But I'm not sure, like, because you mentioned that there was also going to be rumors of a new Concorde agreement that will potentially limit to only 10 Formula 1 teams on the grid, right? For our listeners who are not so well-versed on what the Concorde agreement is, could you just like talk us through like what's it about? I know they kind of renews the Concorde agreement every once now and then. But yeah, I just wanted to know, like, what is it? Like, yeah, what is the Concorde agreement?
The Concorde agreement is basically a three-way agreement between the teams of Formula One, Formula One management handling all the commercial rights, all the TV deals and revenue from that, as well as the FIA itself. It's a three-way agreement to guarantee that the teams get paid for their races, they get adequate supplies, to make sure that they can compete. The teams agree to compete and not miss any number of races that they won. And the FOM agrees to pay FIA a certain amount of the revenue in addition to the teams for the right to broadcast this throughout the world. The FIA is essentially renting it out to FOM. So it's a three-way agreement. And then in this agreement, in addition to this basic things that they've agreed on, there are things that indicate or limit things that they can do. and these change year on year depending on the Concorde Agreement. So they tend to get renewed about every 8 years or so, and then like there's a new set of regulations and everything. Like they say, it could be things like no tobacco sponsorship, or it could be things like championships and championship deciders will be decided differently, or there could be something like no 3 races in a row in 3 consecutive weeks, right, or something. Right. It depends on the teams and how they organize it. The current Concorde Agreement, which was signed in 2021, had an anti-dilution fee for new Formula One teams to join. They would have to pay $200 million US into a fund which will be distributed among the 10. And so that was agreed at a time, so which Michael Andretti has stated that he's prepared to pay. If he's being prevented from driving even after paying that, it could be a breach. And if there's a new agreement that says no, instead of the current limit of 13 teams on the calendar, now we only want 10,
right,
forever and forever,
right,
that could be a problem. And say that there will never be a new team.
Just a follow-up, right? Like, what does it mean? What does anti-dilution mean? Or what's an anti-dilution fee?
So, basically, anti-dilution would be because at the end of the year, teams get allocated like a certain amount of money from the TV rights that they arrange around the world, in addition to the prize money they receive in based on where they finish in the Constructors' Championship. But the TV money that they get is evenly split among all 10 teams.
Right.
So, this anti-dilution fee is basically to offset an 11 team coming in and to have that pool of money being split 11 ways. So instead of, let's say, if it's 110 million, previously every team will get 10 million. No, every team will get 11 million, and now every team will get 10 million. So it's diluted in that way. So the fee is supposed to substitute for that. But now the teams are saying that it's not enough, and they're like, they shouldn't be this way. So yada, yada, yada. It's basically about money.
Right, right. And speaking about money, I think Liberty Media has spent some extra cash. I'm not sure where they are cutting it. I mean, obviously, the F1 brand has grew significantly after they bought over the brand in 2017, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, I should be right. So after they brought over the brand in 2017, the brand F1 has just experienced global visibility with stuff like Drive to Survive, you know, expanding and tapping into new markets, you know, specifically in the US where they're doing Miami, they're doing Austin, they're doing Vegas, and rumors have it that they're going to do Chicago as well, which is insane. So yeah, so Formula One US-based owner Liberty Media has recently announced a takeover of MotoGP, I mean, the very famous two-wheeler driving series. They announced the takeover of MotoGP's parent company Dorna on Monday, valuing the world's largest motorcycle racing championship at €4.2 billion. That's about $4.5 billion USD, according to Reuters. Dorna will stay an independently run company attributed to Liberty's Media Formula One Group trading stock and continues to be based in Madrid, and the CEO is basically safe. So yeah, basically Liberty Media bought over MotoGP. I personally think, looking at what they've done to Formula One, it should help the sport gain improved visibility so far. But yeah, I'm just curious about what are your thoughts, John?
I mean, I would like to clarify to these listeners that Liberty Media bought over MotoGP's television rights, the commercial rights. You can't buy a sport. So they bought over the commercial elements, similar to how Liberty Media currently owns Formula One management. They own the commercial and advertising and the commercial aspects to it. But all these, in that sense, like Formula One management is leased out, and the rights to Formula One have been leased out from the FIA to Formula One management, which is owned by Liberty Media. I'm not exactly sure if it works the same way, but MotoGP, I think, is leased out to Dorna, in this case, the commercial rights holder, from FIM. The MotoGP is regulator. And then now Liberty Media has bought over the commercial rights. So basically, what they can do is basically handle all the promotional aspects, to arrange the races.
But okay.
They can't set any of the rules for MotoGP.
Correct. Yeah, I was under the impression they bought over the sport, but okay, they bought over the commercial rights to the sport. Okay, that's a completely different thing.
You can't buy
over the sport.
You can't.
Yeah, technically, because...
You can't own a sport.
Is MotoGP under the FIA?
No. MotoGP is under FIM. Like, it's for the two-wheeler sport.
Correct.
FIA is basically anything with four wheels.
And then FIM is anything with two wheels.
Yeah. theoretically. So things like Formula E, the World Endurance Championship, and yeah, things like that are all under FIA. So things like motorcycle, all the different classes, the 500cc, MotoGP, and everything like that, that's all under FIM.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for clarifying, John. But yeah, in terms of what they can do after acquiring the commercial rights to MotoGP, I think the brand should experience improved visibility, better engagement with the market, better activations as well. As, you know, you've seen what they've done to Formula One in such a short period of time.
I'm looking forward to Ride to Survive.
Yeah. We have Drive to Survive for Formula One. Now we have Ride to Survive in MotoGP. I swear, if they're actually putting that as a name for the show, I will flip like,
If that is the name for the show, you heard it here first. Ride to Survive, coming
Ride to
Netflix.
Survive. Awesome. Ride to Survive. And yeah, with that, I think that brings us close to the end of our write of our show. We just have one last point that we wanted to touch on, which is the 2025 Formula One season calendar is actually being reviewed. So I've had a look at it. It's pretty interesting, but John, I'll let you do the honors for this.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, my first comment was 24 races is way too long.
I agree. I agree.
I'm with the FIA, the head of the FIA on this. It's like, we need less races and more teams. Yes, I agree with that. So that's out of the way, too long. But I mean, besides that, it's nice to have a traditional season opener again. It's like, it's nice to have Australia be the season opener again. Long-time F1 viewers know that Australia has been traditionally been the season opener for many years. The last time it was the season opener, it was right before COVID, so not the best memories there. So yeah, that's nice. And then they have things like China and Japan coming up, which ties into what the FIA is trying to arrange for more regional scheduling for the most part. Except for somehow they're going from Spain to Canada to Austria in consecutive races. I don't get it. Probably something related to money, as it always is. But they've done some elements of regional scheduling. So things like the US, Brazil, Mexico, they're all together. The European races are all in the middle around throughout the summer. Asian races, except for Singapore, are all towards the beginning. The Asian races. Asia Pacific, Australia, China, Japan, yeah, and except Singapore. Then things like Qatar and Abu Dhabi are towards the end, yeah, together. So that makes more sense, but I could see some more regional, ties back into something I said on a friend's podcast previously, was it could be something to be promoted, like if the season was exciting enough, it'd be interesting to see things like, this is the Asian champion, this is the European champion, and this is the American champion or something like that. American champion of the Formula One season or what? Because have like a mini championship within a championship for more storylines if the cars are competitive enough. But yeah, it makes more sense, especially for like different leagues. And then like, let's say you can have four Asian races in a row, and then like at the end it's like the highest scoring driver for Asian races. Then eight in Europe. Then the European races are all like tallied together. Then total, you have the world championship. But then, like, these are just like mini things to look out for. But yeah, what do you think about it, Nathan?
Yeah, I mean, shout out to you, Timo, from the Undercut Podcast. And thanks for letting us having that discussion. I personally think that moving Japan a lot earlier, I think this year with Japan, it was actually really beautiful because it's during the Sakura season. So it was just amazing to see the cars going near the Sakura trees and everything.
The scenery was amazing.
Yeah, it was really, really great. I think that was ironically one of the best decisions you could do Formula One. But yeah, and the fact that they brought Japan a lot earlier into the season, I felt like that race was actually really, really interesting. I have no idea why, but the strategy battles for that race was really, really good. Even though there was no fight for the win, yada, yada, you know, Max Verstappen winning. It was really nice. So I really appreciate the fact that they brought Japan a lot earlier as well. And as we've seen with China having, recently during the spring qualifying, it was kind of like raining, mixed conditions as well. So that's interesting. I've never actually watched a race in China before because thanks to COVID, so it'll be really interesting to see the race this weekend at the time of recording. And I'm pretty certain that bringing all of the races by region does help to cut like the carbon emissions and everything. Though I kind of understand why they put Singapore quite late towards the end, even though it makes no freaking sense. But yeah, there's that. Yes, 24 races in a season is way too long. So yeah, definitely they should just like cut it down a little bit. But it is what it is, right? Money talks in F1.
Cut it down, maybe have some races rotate on like a every 2 years once kind of thing. Maybe have things like Monaco, Silverstone, Monza, Spa, maybe Brazil, and maybe Albert Park or something like that. Maybe have like a few set races and then the rest can rotate. And shout out to Sepang, where we're waiting for you.
Yeah. I think this is not... Okay, this isn't Formula 1 related, but yes, there were rumors of Formula 1 returning to Sepang. If the listeners don't know, we are both Malaysians and we've been dying to have Formula 1 come back to Sepang. And there were rumors that Malaysia was also going to host the final round of the Formula E World Championship as well. So yeah, that's that. I mean, till that day comes, we can only wish.
The closest we have is only Singapore.
Yeah, I mean, and even then it's still expensive, right? You know, 1 ringgit is about, 3.5 ringgit is about $1. So I'm like,
it's expensive. And the 100% safety car rate in Singapore is interesting for strategy, but it's not the most exciting track to see things happen.
Yeah. There's that. So yeah, with that, thanks a lot for listening to this episode. If you'd like to hear more from us or see more from us, don't forget to follow us on Spotify, give us a review on what you thought about this episode, and follow us on our LinkedIn page for the latest updates, whether that's, you know, a new newsletter, a new Grand Prix preview or post-race finding. We will always keep you up to date. Shout out to our writer Gaston for, you know, smashing it and keep cooking all those interesting and...
Appreciate it, Gaston. You're doing a great job.
You're doing a great job, Gaston. So yeah, with that, we have come to the end of our episode. Took us slightly longer because we thought it was going to be a short episode, but really, really interesting discussion. Love everything that was on here so far. So yeah, any closing thoughts before we end off the episode, John?
Yeah, I mean, my main thoughts would be looking forward to the Chinese Grand Prix this weekend, and we are heading towards the European season, which hopefully there should be something going on with the rest of the season. There's no chance of a Red Bull perfect season, but hopefully we have something more exciting storylines coming up.
So with that, once again, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Jonathan.
So stay safe. I'll see you in the next episode.